Disclaimer. The views and opinions that you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. The show tapes live most Thursdays, 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time on YouTube. Check out my Twitter feed, ANNZAG, for more. Enjoy the show! Welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Borchi. Jacob's here.
Hey, folks.
And joining us today for our Psychopaths discussion, Gabrielle Atkins. You know her from the site. You can read her weekly reviews of spring 2017 anime.
She's covering Rage of Bahamut.
Sagrada
Reset.
Yeah, there you go. Sagrada Reset. We're covering Sagrada Reset?
Apparently.
I guess we are.
Yeah, apparently.
Jacob usually handles a lot of the daily streaming stuff.
I handle all of it.
Gabrielle, thanks for coming on the program.
No problem.
So we're doing a series discussion this time. It's Psychopaths.
Psychopaths cast.
Both seasons and the film.
Yes.
I guess we'll get started in the way that we normally do. Jacob, take it away, I guess.
I feel like you should explain it, though, because, like, it's fresher on... I didn't have time to rewatch the whole thing, but I've seen it several times, so I feel like the plot's fresher in your memory.
Sure. Well, I can't give you an exact rundown. I started watching it over in pieces and everything, but the basic gist of it is it's the future. How many years into the future is it?
Unknown.
I mean, so the movie starts... The movie gives a date, it's 2117 or something like that. 2117. You're about 100 years into the future or so, and I'm going to give the basic premise. You'll do the plot, all right?
Okay.
So the basic premise is that they've set up a system where, I didn't run through this before starting. You sprung it on me. You usually do this part.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't have anything really prepared, and you have the show like memorized back to front. So could you maybe do this part?
All right. So see, I didn't know that it took place at a specific time in the future, but it is a dystopia future where people live in sort of a Minority Report-esque society where crime is predicted before it happens and punished before it happens. Basically, the way that they sum it up is the villain says, science has figured out the way to quantify a human soul. And so they can reduce your capability and likelihood of committing a crime in the near future to a number. And so that's called your crime coefficient. And so anybody with a crime coefficient above, I think, like 100 is considered a danger to society, and anybody above 300 is kill on sight. So the society is mostly peaceful. The Sybil system is the name of this giant, like, supercomputer that gauges everybody's like likelihood of committing crime or not committing crime. And so the Sybil system is also able to decide by looking at your personality what occupation you would best fit into, the trajectory of your life, your, like, love projections, all this stuff. So everybody just sort of relies on the Sybil system for everything, and it kind of feels comfortable in the knowledge that maybe, like, there won't be any crime committed and they can just walk around their daily lives, leave their doors unlocked, all that good stuff, because anybody who is capable of doing crime will be caught immediately and put into therapy or killed if they're really crazy. So that's the setup, and then we spend all our time with members of the MWPSB, which stands for, like, something welfare society. It's basically the newspeak term for the police, because the police act very differently in this society because of the way it is. You have detectives who are able to sort of think like criminals and do this typical detective work, but that means that they have really high psychopaths, they have really high crime coefficients. So normally they wouldn't be able to live in society, but because they're working as police officers, called enforcers, they're allowed to exist outside of treatment centers and jail and stuff like that. And then you have the inspectors, who are the police who aren't supposed to do anything and are just supposed to sort of manage things bureaucratically and make sure that the enforcers don't do anything bad. And so that's their job. And so you have a new inspector, Akane, I don't remember.
Sunamori.
Sunamori. Akane Sunamori, who is like new to the job and sort of figuring it out, and she's sort of like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and naive, and then she quickly starts falling for one of the enforcers, who is like sort of the standard like detective who has like a vendetta out for the criminal who got away with murdering his partner, and that sort of that revenge plot consumes his life. And then you have the other colorful members of the welfare bureau, and it's all about life under this system and also what is the nature of the system. And so it's sort of a classical dystopia in the style of like Gibson and Huxley and all those. So
okay, so you just gave a perfect end-to-end summary that I could not have given as accurately as you. I just want to point out,
okay,
I had a plan for the show for a reason.
Okie dokie. Well, I guess it's
that
guess,
was perfect.
See, now,
thank you.
If I lived under the Sybil system, they would make me a plot summarizer if that was a job, and that's just that'd be
I mean,
my job.
It's not that. It's not that.
Just kidding. I'd get labeled a latent criminal, probably from an early age, and put behind bars. That's probably what would happen to me.
So this is again Urobuchi joint. Yeah. At least the first season is. Mm-hmm. And it was originally aired in like 22 episodes or so. Mm-hmm. And the version that I watched is the one that's on Funimation's streaming site, which is like a director's cut where it's...
When they re-aired it, because it was massively popular, they re-aired it like in one core by squishing the episodes together, adding a little more connective tissue that really helps, I think, make it feel more like a cohesive thing. It was to begin with, but it makes it feel more cohesive, and then... Yeah, it's just basically like Psycho Pass Plus. And it's, you know.
Yeah, those episodes are like 45 minutes long. And in that format, I did find myself kind of wishing some of them were 22 minutes instead. Like, it goes on for a little long sometimes. But it's a good version of the show. I didn't feel like I was missing anything at the end. Like, there was no... I didn't have any questions aside from big picture questions. What happened in the narrative was clear to me.
Right.
So was there a bunch of connective tissue missing in the broadcast version that made it just clarification that needed to happen, or
it's not plot clarification. The whole thing makes sense either way. Everything that they added is like an extra scene of Makishima at the beginning showing that he was behind this, he was behind all the murders, instead of having to introduce that a little later. And, yeah, basically connective tissue that makes Makishima more the villain very obviously from the beginning, besides just the opening scene, which shows that he's the villain. But they lace it through a little better, and it's like, oh, okay, this feels more like a cohesive thing.
Yeah, okay. Well, it felt very cohesive to me. So, like, you kind of went a little nuts for this show. Like, you love it.
Weirdly,
love it.
Weirdly, it was on.
And if you
re-watches.
Try to downplay it right now,
weirdly,
we're gonna have some words.
It was on rewatches, because if you read, so I reviewed this show for the site, and this was before I knew I was a big fan of Gen Urobuchi, or I guess it was just after I realized I was becoming a fan of him, because it was after Madoka and Fate Zero, and I was like, oh, this guy is really good. And but this was a show when I reviewed it, I actually was the least enthusiastic about it that I've ever been, which is to say, I gave it an A-. And now I'm like, oh, A+, I love this show. But I don't know that would change the grade that I gave it, because it does have all the same flaws that I gave. I look back at that review and I'm like, yeah, I agree with what I said that back then. It's just on a very personal note rather than on an objective review level. Like, I really liked it. Every time I went back to it, I found something new, you know. So it was like, I really loved it more on rewatches than I did the first time, where I was just like, oh, this is really good. But I think it got to me feelings-wise more that I went back to it.
Gabriella, how did you first feel about Psycho Pass? Like, were you immediately taken with it?
Yeah, I'd say so. I saw it about 3 or so years ago. I wrote an editorial on it. I enjoyed it. I've seen it about 3 times now. I got into it in a similar way that Jake did. And I have to say that I'm kind of surprised that every time I rewatch it, I rewatched it right before the show one more time, I still discover a lot of new things about it, and it makes me think a lot of new thoughts, which has surprised me, because I didn't think that. I thought I kind of mind it last time I saw it, but this time it's like, oh, there's even more, which just makes me enjoy it even more.
Cool. I just want to make sure that the chat is hearing your audio.
You guys heard the Skype audio?
Are you hearing Gabba's audio? We've been having some weird difficulty lately.
Okay.
Sorry, there's a couple of seconds delay.
Okay, it's fine.
Just wait for the chat to confirm or deny. Yes, okay, everything's good. Great.
All right, cool.
Okay. And so you were taken with it right away. What was your first, what appealed to it? What about it appealed to you so much?
First of all, I'm a big fan of Urobuchi as a writer. I think he is a distinctly powerful, like, dramatist in terms of story structure and, like, all the character types and sort of arranging all of these characters, which tend to represent similar things in his work, in his various works.
Yeah, Jacob and I were talking about this earlier.
And making them mean something slightly different in each instance, in each show where they repeat, and sort of driving them to a central collision, which is extremely entertaining. But I guess what makes Psycho Pass stand out in particular as one of his works is that it's the most concerned with, like, current events and real life and commenting on that rather than just being, like, say, Monica, which is very abstractly about the concept of entropy in an almost trans-historical sense, or Fate, which is messier and very much about, like, historical figures.
Yeah.
So this is his take on... This is him on current events, basically.
Circa 2012.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That was actually one of my issues with the show, but we'll get to it a little later. Why don't we get into the show itself? Can you start with the beginning of the show? The first, I don't know. There's sort of a little arc at the beginning.
Right. Well, it begins more as a procedural,
right,
where Akane is, like, learning how the job is done, because, well, that's the thing. So under the Sybil system, which is very sort of, it's like Brave New World with, like, a snippet of 1984 and Blade Runner, and then not Blade Runner the movie, but Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep in there. But it's, you know, it's a blending, which is, I think, the show comments on a lot, that it's a blending of all these other things, because it doesn't want to sort of pretend that all this other stuff isn't completely being ripped off. So they have the villain, who is well-read. He's read all these banned books and stuff like that, all these classic sci-fi. He mentions what part of this society is like this other book, and which author got it right and got it wrong, which is basically Urobuchi's way of saying, well, I'm sorry I stole a lot of this stuff, but I know that I stole it, so it's okay.
Apparently, and, you know, those parts were actually put in by his co-writer.
Oh, yeah?
Huh. Which is interesting.
Yeah, well, that is interesting. Yeah. Although, they don't feel like just references, because, like, he addresses the themes of the stuff that he's put in there, like, mm-hmm, very, very integrally.
Hang on. I just want to point out that collaborative writing is just that, collaborative. And somebody doesn't just insert lines into a script and the other writer just says, I don't know where that, like, they all collaborate on the finished product together, and they're... So while you might say, like, oh, he didn't exactly write that himself, that doesn't mean, so that means he had no oversight or approval on the material.
Right.
Like, you can still come to the, for discussion's sake, you can still come to the conclusion, we can still talk about this as a Gen Urobuchi script.
Right.
I'll also just add the co-writer's name so we have it, Makoto Fukami.
Right. He's they know each other from the tabletop. He's the DM for Chaos Dragon.
Oh.
I believe that's
familiar faces.
So they kind of work together on this, but, like, what was I saying? Oh, right. So the beginning of it is, because of the society is the way it is, where it sort of pacifies people and tells them everything that they have to do, so they don't really have to think for themselves. Akane isn't really, like, briefed on the job so much before, which is sort of his excuse to give us, like, a perspective character. She's not told the details of the job and how difficult it's going to be and stuff like that before she's slotted into it. She's just supposed to, like, do what she's told. And so the more that she's like, oh, this is how this works, I'm just supposed to stand by while you, like, murder people based on how stressed they are, which is a lot of it. Like, you know, crime coefficients go up with the level of, like, stress and proneness to violence that people exhibit, but they exhibit those things because they're being hunted by, you know, the police. And so, she kind of bumps up against, like, well, this is a little bit twisted, isn't it? And but she just kind of has to go with it, because what else is she going to do? And so that allows the procedural format to kind of play out, with her going, well, this is kind of weird and seems, you know, opposite to enforcing peace in a society. And everybody else is like, you must be new. Like, they don't disagree with her, because they are enforcers. They're latent criminals. So they think like criminals. They understand the impulse to say, like, the system is wrong. But, like, they, you know, what are they going to do about it? So they're just like, you must be new. And, yes, you're right, but whatever, it's our job. And, so all of these murders and all these, little side stories that they go down, all these crimes, which are other things like, commentaries on how social media affects people and how factory, like, basically how enclosed systems like a factory can kind of turn into another high school setting where people are bullied to keep the other people pacified, that kind of stuff. Just little just explorations he wants to go down are all connected to one guy who is manipulating all of these murders and all of these crimes, whose name is Shogo Makishima. And Shogo Makishima just so happens to be the guy who helped kill the partner of our main enforcer guy, who has that revenge vendetta. So he's like, I found him, and you know,
yeah.
And so that's,
remember when I killed your brother, Eddie?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that's our plot, and that will lead us to the heart of the Sybil system and finding out really where it came from and like what it really, really is. So, you know,
yeah. And so like some of Fate Zero. And some of Madoka, and most of, you know, some of all of his projects. This is the most two characters who represent an individual philosophy walk into a room, and then they talk about the situation that they're in as it relates to their personal philosophy. Like, it's almost like, I'm this sort of person, and here's how I'm reacting to this. And the two bounce their ideas off of each other. And for the most part, it's really good and really thought-provoking and fun. However, they are not characters, and I didn't care about them in the way that I would a character. Mm-hmm. Kogami is so obviously Urobuchi's self-insert, mm-hmm. drinking his whiskey, punching the fighting robot on the hardest difficulty. Such a badass, Kogami. How do you do it?
But he's tortured.
Figuring everything out, you know, all that mm-hmm. stuff. So that I was kind of laughing at like this obvious self-insert. But the two characters walk in, present their personality and their philosophy, and then hash it out mm-hmm. was fun, but it did feel like that was like 75% of the runtime of the show,
right.
Which like I understand, but like, so he's making the show in the mold of like Ghost in the Shell.
Yes.
And
which was what he was commissioned to do.
Right.
We should bring up, like, Psychopass wasn't, I've got an idea. It was...
We need something like this.
It was production IG going, well, it's a something-something anniversary of something-something. We need another... What they specifically asked him for was another Ghost in the Shell, but some Pat Labor, too. Because they were like, we want it to be a workplace thing, but we want it to have the urgency and, like, the big, like, violent coolness of Ghost in the Shell. But we want it to be, like, people now want a little more slice of life. So can you make it
a
procedure?
They want Ghost in the Shell, Pat Labor.
Ghost in the Shell, Pat Labor. And so the director of
So the Ghost in the Shell manga.
Yeah.
They could have just adapted the manga.
They could, but we wouldn't have Psychobiz. But, like, the director...
They wouldn't own it outright.
The director of this is actually a live-action director. So they hired two direct. Like, they went all out. Like, the show looks great. Like,
yeah.
The production
it looks.
Are
the
great.
First season looks great.
Yeah. They dumped a lot of money into it, or at least a lot of resources, if people don't want me to use the word money specifically. They cared a lot. They wanted this to succeed. They hired two directors. So you have an animation director who's in charge of this typical animation director stuff. And then for the big picture stuff, they hired a guy who just has done live action police procedurals because that's what they wanted to make. And then they said, Urobuchi, would you write this? And he said, if I can make it, he said, can I make it like commentative, like about the other sci-fi that I've read? Can I make it sort of Blade Runner-y? I know you didn't ask for Blade Runner, but can I put some Blade Runner in there? And he's like, yeah, and they're like, yeah, sure. So that's actually where this came from. So it's a project by committee, and usually those do not turn out well. But, you know, Urobuchi's a good writer, so it turned out pretty good.
Well, and they obviously gave him free rein to do what he wants.
Yeah.
I found myself getting a little impatient with the themes because I knew, like, they established stuff and then they reestablished stuff, like, a lot. Like, there's a lot of repetition. Yeah. And I get that, but it was kind of like I was just waiting to find out the thematic conclusion. I was waiting to find out what it was going to say and what sort of message it was going to have about all of this stuff, about all these various things that it obviously has a lot to say about.
Mm-hmm.
So I found myself getting impatient with it because the procedural part of it was not very interesting to me. Like, it was kind of standard Ghost in the Shell-y sort of stuff.
See, I liked that.
It was neat and everything, but the visual ideas in it, they're not that exciting. Mm-hmm. They're not that unique. Like, it's an okay... It's all right. It's not like... My eyes weren't bugging out of my head or anything. Like, the second opening sequence, I think, is probably the best thing in that... Like, visually, best-looking thing in that show. Even better than the film, I think. So that stuff wasn't all that interesting to me. So what was cool about it was, hey, what is Urobuchi's hot take? I want to get to the end of his hot take.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the end of the hot take is like, well, we'll get to it.
Surprise.
But I found myself, like, it sounds like you two had a much more traditional kind of, like, I'm enjoying the show and these characters and I want to see how it ends. And I found myself focusing exclusively on what it was trying to say,
mm-hmm.
to the exclusion of most of the other elements of the show. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that was a bad reaction I have to it or something.
Well, I mean, so you shotgunned it is the other thing. And I watched it, like, not week to week. I was watching
I watched it in segments, like, big chunks.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
But, like, I do think, like, I think I was able to watch it slower because you got through it in like 2 or 3 days, and I think the experience of watching it week to week or just slower allows you to marinate in the individual themes that it's addressing more. Well, like, okay, so
they're
just
not that complicated.
Well,
I don't need
to
marinate.
The social media, just the Spooky Boogie episode, like, I thought that had some interesting things to say about how we relate to social media and stuff like that. Like, that on its own. Now, yeah, it's not the main theme, but it's like, oh, that's interesting.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about that. Let's stop there, because that's an early episode that we can find a theme and hash it out a little bit. Gabbo, can you tell us a little bit about that episode and what happens in it and what they're trying to get across?
So Spooky Boogie is, they're chasing down, they have to investigate this, like, poser internet anarchist who, like, has, like, an internet persona based on being, like, anti-government and anti-cop. And they're, like, suspecting that she's involved in some crimes or has information. Mm-hmm. And she does give them information for more of a real criminal who they suspect – oh, yeah. They suspect that he's been killing and replacing other internet personalities.
Mm-hmm. Including Spooky Booger.
Eventually.
Spooky Booger.
Yeah.
Spooky Booger.
Spooky Booger. Spurger Burger.
Yeah. Boogie.
Yeah.
And becoming – it ultimately is revealed that this guy, manipulated by Makishima – is killing the internet personalities and taking them over to become what he perceives as more authentic versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because the Spooky Boogie person wasn't like a real, like,
not a real anarchist. So
yeah.
Therefore,
yeah. She cooperated with the police.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting line in there where they say, like, you know, really, like, the person who's going to give the fans the ideal version of this character, like what they want, mm-hmm. is going to be an obsessive fan. It's not going to be a writer or somebody like, If we want to hire somebody to pacify these people with these characters, you have mm-hmm. to hire somebody who's obviously going to produce exactly that effect.
Right. Who's not giving them the real person, because the real person can't boil themselves down to an internet personality. They choose what to show the public in order to propagate a brand, basically.
Yeah.
And so this guy who is, you know, spends all his time online and basically perceives these personalities as gods, when he is disappointed by them, by the reality of who they are, instead of like most people maybe learning from that and moving on, he's like, well, I have to replace that because I'm clearly better at whatever they would be. And it's not just, he's not an anarchist. He doesn't believe in anarchy, but he's like, he replaces somebody who's a therapist as well, who has like a therapy show, and then he replaces somebody else who they don't specify what he's on about, but it is like, specifically, he believes that these people are not good enough representations of these things. But then they catch him because the thesis and the thing that I liked about this episode was, like, they bring up, like, the social media personalities may not match your ideal, but they are cohesive, like, personalities in and of themselves, and they're able to catch this guy as an imposter because he is himself, even though he's trying to impersonate these other people. Like, he has their avatars, he has their voices, he has everything that should make them him, but when he says things like the previous owner of this avatar referred to them as the welfare bureau, and now it says the police, and it's like, well, this is not terminology that they would ever use. So the idea is that anonymity doesn't make you able to become anybody. You can't help but be yourself regardless of what mask you put on, what form of anonymity you take, which I liked, because a lot of people that talk about social media, they're like, oh, you can become anyone. And it's like, no, you are tricked because you believe you can become anyone. Really, you're tricked into being more yourself than in any other.
Yeah,
context.
You can put on any mask you want, but your voice is still your voice. Like, you're still trapped with yourself.
And with your guard down, it's more likely to actually come out because you think that nobody can tell who you really are.
It's also a good depiction of how people tend to actually use the internet, as in, like, represent themselves online, mm-hmm. and sort of internet personas.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so it's so all those early episodes are basically like that. They're not. They're about completely different topics.
Kind of one-offs, little essays on whatever.
Right. Like the obviously Urobuchi has some thoughts about all girls academies as well, and that's all completely different. You know. So like the episode about factory workers is not the episode about social media, is not the episode about all girls
man
schools.
Hunting man.
Yeah. Oh gosh, the most dangerous game. I forgot about that. Which is just him going, the most dangerous game would be cooler with cyborgs and cyborg dogs. You know, that kind of thing. So
yeah. Yeah, so it kind of kills time for a little while. Mm-hmm. But then we sort of get into the main plot, which pits, the main character against Shogo, mm-hmm. the white-haired literature reading...
who can't tuck in his goddamn shirt.
Like devil half of Ganyu Urobuchi, who...
Kyubei.
Yeah, the Kyubei that, like... You can't, like, Kyubei had a point. Mm-hmm. Entropy is real. Mm-hmm. We're all going to be strangled by it at some point. That's true. It's going to happen. Like, he's right. Mm-hmm. So you can, in the same, and Shogo is kind of right in the same way. Mm-hmm. Like, he's, and the show, like, empathizes with him and tries to empathize with him. And it's obvious that, like, Urobuchi thinks this dude has at least kind of a point. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I found myself thinking, he really does have like a pretty good point, especially like near the end. There's a sequence where he's traveling towards the climax of the show, and he has a long interior monologue about this stuff, mm-hmm. and it made a lot of sense to me because I thought that what they were depicting was such a terrifying, unconscionable crushing of the human spirit that like A, humanity would never adapt to it, mm-hmm. and B, it was existentially terrifying to me because I knew like immediately I would probably be thrown in
thought
a prison.
Thought
crimes right fucking away. Like I'm a passionate guy. I have a temper. Like I get mad and sad and happy and like I you know
you
I'm
don't a, bend to authority thoughtlessly. You know it's like.
Yeah, but not as like a I'm a cool guy thing.
No,
it's like
just,
it just you
this
just,
is a tendency
it's a personality
of many people.
Type. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But not only that, but the way they described that society was basically if you get too upset, they throw you in jail, and like all art is inherently banned and selected by the system, and then the people who become artists are also selected by the system, and it's this the only people allowed into the system are the people who agree with it, mm-hmm. and the only people who are allowed to exist publicly are people who agree with the system,
right? Which gives the illusion that it's perfect because everybody agrees with it, because anybody who doesn't agree with it disappears,
which is sort of a fundamental thing towards the end, mm-hmm. and that's really terrifying to me. So the idea that like I have to destroy this, I have to free these people, just you know, his motivation and everything was all fucked up, but like this is not how humans are meant to live. This is worthless. It's not life. Mm-hmm. And I agree with him.
Right.
It's worthless.
Even
it's
though
not life.
We should clarify, we haven't talked much about his character, but he is a violent psychopath who like specifically his raison d'etre, his thing in life is to find people who have maybe tendency to murder and then give them all the resources they need to go on a killing spree. That's what he does with his life, what he's chosen to do with his life. So, and yet, he has a point, which is, I think, the goal of the show. Like, so, the title is a pun. Psychopaths, which is the thing that, like, tells you what how sane you are. And it is a homophone for, in Japanese, psychopasu, psychopath. So, you know, there's our hint. And so, I guess we should just, like, reveal what the Sybil system really is. Maybe.
So, well,
Rangers.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about how we get to that point. There's a climax where Kogami leaves the agent, the bureau, mm-hmm. right? So can we get through that plot?
Well, he leaves the bureau at the very, very end. We find out about the what Sybil system is before that.
He goes off and investigates. He's not supposed to pursue Shogo after a certain point, right?
Yeah, so like he goes kind of rogue, I think. After the thing with the helmets.
Yeah, the thing with the helmets, and then he winds up going rogue. Mm-hmm. And Shogo that manufactures these helmets?
Yeah. Yeah.
That they have. So everyone gets these Briareos looking helmets, these Appleseed looking helmets mm-hmm. that can confuse the system. And the goal is these things can no longer read your psychopass. What it does is it just takes whatever the nearest low psychopass number is and spits that out back into the system.
Uh-huh.
The idea is to create riots, expose the system for being flawed to the population, which mm-hmm. then starts rioting. Mm-hmm. And that's to distract attention away from the Sybil headquarters because, so that he can get in there and fuck
Yeah, because the police system, because if you have a thing where crime is rarer and rarer because it's predictive, the police force shrinks and becomes more highly specialized, so, like, they're not prepared to deal with riots. So right. all of their energy goes to the toward the riots, and he can just sort of stroll on into the welfare bureau.
Yeah. And this is where we come back to the In Media Res opening at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was a lot of show left afterward once we had gotten back to that point. It was like, there's, like, 90 minutes of this show.
They haven't explained what Sybil is.
Yeah, right. So that all that stuff happens, and then at long last, we are told what Sybil actually is, mm-hmm. which, do you want to go through that?
brain jars.
Right.
So, no, okay, so more specifically, it's not just anyone's brain.
Specific brains.
Specific brains. So basically, all this stuff happens, and Shogo gets into the welfare bureau to find out what Sybil it really is, and he gets arrested. And then he finds out anyway, because Sybil takes an interest in him. They're like, no, don't kill him. We need him. And so they take him in a secret helicopter to explain to him what the Sybil system is and why they want him to be a part of it. Because it turns out what the Sybil system is, as they have advertised to the public, a completely impartial way of judging everybody else's, like, tendency to commit crime, because it is composed entirely of brains of psychopaths, specifically people with no capacity or an extremely underdeveloped capacity for empathy. Because what a psychopath actually measures, your crime coefficient going up and down, is your reaction of remorse or guilt or fear or anger, any of those adverse emotions to the idea of committing a crime. Psychopaths, by their very nature, because they lack empathy, do not have this reaction to committing any kind of moral, you know, anything. They just live by their id. That's what a psychopath is. So, therefore, technically speaking, this is why they can never bring in Shogo. When you point their guns, which can only fire if somebody has a high crime coefficient, at Shogo Makishima or any psychopath, they would read like 0 or 10 or something, a low number, because there's not a whole lot of conflict going on in there. There's almost no conflict to anything that they pursue that they want to do. They just live by their id, and there's no remorse or fear or anger to that if they're doing what they want to do. So anyway, point being, this system is made up of psychopathic brains, and they're like, society once treated us as monsters, and now we are a god. We are, because we don't use emotionality, like, basically, society wanted a system of judgment that was like a computer, that was totally impartial. That's what kind of people have been wanting for many, many decades, maybe the history of the justice system, and we are that. So now, yeah, we can't kill anybody, we can't follow our id that way, but we've achieved a state of becoming God to all of the silly empaths, and so now we can judge them for having emotions. And so that's why the Sybil system punishes emotion and stress and, like, deviation, any neuroatypical thing that causes you to be a slight disruption to an otherwise peaceful, passive society. And so they're like, we want your brain, Shogo. Unfortunately, Makishima's specific id, his specific raison d'etre, is independence for its own sake, is just being able to do what you want to do, individualism, freedom. And so he doesn't really like this idea, and so he says nope, and he blows up the helicopter and leaves. Well, all the other psychopaths were kind of happy to be part of the system because they just didn't value freedom as its own thing, untied to any other value. But unfortunately, this guy does. So he escapes, and this begins another chase where they're like, well, you have to go get him. And this is when everybody's like, there's something wrong here. And so they begin to unravel what the system actually is, because they're like, why can't we kill this guy on sight? Well, you can't. You just have to go get him. And, you know. So there you go. It's brains in jars.
Right. And that's kind of the reveal. And that's once that's revealed, you kind of think, wait, are they going to do something about it? And no, not really. Like, they don't. It feels like there was going to be a conclusion, but the show I guess that's not possible. It would have been all written out beforehand, but it feels like there would have been a stronger conclusion had the show not been so popular. Because it doesn't have any reason to go into a second season after this one's done.
No.
Except for the fact that they don't resolve it. They don't really get into, like, okay, but this can't exist. Like, they don't really get into that stuff.
Do you mean resolving it as in getting rid of Sybil?
Yeah, like getting rid of it, dealing with it, dealing with the system directly.
I think, well, they purposefully don't. I think that's the message of the show, is that they don't try to dismantle the system because the
society couldn't exist without it.
Society can't. Society has unfortunately gotten to the point where they can't handle a world without it yet. So the goal, Akane's stated goal, is like, well, we can't just come in here and take you apart. We have to try to alter the values of society to where they would want to see to not use you anymore.
Yeah, right.
Which is very much more difficult, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I liked the ending, and I appreciated what it was trying to say and everything. But ultimately, when it was all over, I was like, okay, I feel like he has wrung every last drop of thematic anything out of this. I feel like he's gotten everything there is to say, and I was baffled that there even was a second season. Like, a movie I could see, but a second season, which we're not at quite yet, I just couldn't. I didn't understand why it would even exist. It felt like you've discussed everything at length. Everything there really is, it feels like you wanted to discuss in these episodes.
It feels like the only things you could do after that is explain how this system got into place.
Right.
Or explain how you would go about dismantling it, neither of which he was interested in doing. He just wanted to explore the system as it is, which is totally in keeping with the tradition of classical sci-fi as it exists. Both Brave New World, 1984, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. In all of those cases, the system is not dismantled. The entire point is to explore it and then see what sad fate awaits the protagonist who says this is wrong. Luckily, like, Akane survives, and if it was true classical sci-fi, she'd get killed. But, like, because the idea is, if this happened, like, what would it fully look like? It's not about, like, and things were okay because we brought it back to what you think is okay now. And it's like, no, we don't need to talk about what you think is okay now. That's up to you. What we need to talk about is, what do you think of if this was real? And so you can never really take down the system. If you do, it's a different kind of story. So, yeah.
Well, I felt like those were really the only interesting places for it to go, mm-hmm. were those places.
Right, which is just sort of its own, you know.
But before we get to the second season, Gabba, what, in your opinion, what do you think the major, like, main theme, like, what do you think Urobuchi's main thing that he was trying to say was? I mean, there's a lot mm-hmm. going on in the show, but what do you think the big sentence is at the end of the first season of Psycho-Pass? Like, what's your takeaway?
Well, there are many, as you
many,
said.
Was the strongest one to you?
The one that struck me most after this third viewing was its, like, repudiation or refusal to engage with the idea of utopia, which right. also gets into some of your criticisms that you just expressed, where it never really seems to have a resolution where... They never kind of resolve the conflict between Akane and Kogami. Mm-hmm. They never find out how to take down the system. They never decide which option of those two was the best one working within the system or working outside of it. They really... As the Sybil system presents itself as sort of this, like, neutral black box computer program, which does the best thing in everyone's interest, but it turns out that that's a facade to suit the interests of the actual human people who make up and exist behind it. At the same time, the show, and that's a repudiation of that idea of a utopia. Meanwhile, right. the show refuses to actually, like, posit its own version of an ideal world at the end, just show how these two individuals with their own, who are shown as good and have their own idealistic ideas that they are more or less pragmatic about, attempt to do good in this world, rather than say, like, then Kogami made the perfect world, then Akane made the perfect world.
Right. It's kind of like Madoka or all the other stuff he makes, where it's like, utilitarianism is the law of the universe, and the universe in this case being the Sybil system, even though that's technically you can take it down. It's not, like, literally the universe, literally entropy like Madoka, but it is, for all intents and purposes, the universe that they are forced to live in. And it's like, utilitarianism is the law of the land. It's unfeeling, but you as an individual can choose not to address that. And it's just, so maybe utopia isn't possible because everybody has different values. Akane and Kogami are never going to have the same values. However...
they're both good people trying their best.
They're both good. And it's summed up... So at the beginning of the show, when Ginoza is like... the stick-up-his-ass inspector who's, like, doing the inspector thing the way you're supposed to do it, and, you know, Akane is like, but maybe it's wrong. So when she first meets him at the beginning, he introduces the enforcers as, now, these aren't people like you or me, these are dogs. You know, and we find out later, like, he has personal reasons for that, a.k.a. daddy issues. But, like, you know, he's these are dogs, and, you know, like, he talks about, like, there's different, like, pure people, latent criminals, etc., and it's, like, trying to segment things. And then when Akane takes his place as head inspector, and she, when there's another inspector that she brings in, and she has to introduce the enforcers for the first time, she says, now, these are people just like you or me. They just have very different values, and they have different ways of seeing the world and processing it, but they are people like you and me, which, and is, that extends to even Makishima, who is, you know, you were like, oh, he has some good points, but he's a violent psychopath. And that is, like, I think the most ambitious thing that this show tries to do, which is to say that psychopaths, people, you know, who are written off as monsters in the real world, are human. We may not like that because it sucks and it's sad and it's an example of, like, you know, cruelty in the world and natural order, but, like, it's true. Psychopaths are human. And I think even Akane's saying at the end, like, these are humans just like you or me, is she's extending that to the civil system as well. It's not God. It's not an impartial anything. It's a system of self-interested human beings that society wrote off as not that, as monsters. And now, like, they're like, now we're God. And it's like, no, you're neither. And the reason that utopia isn't possible is because you have all these differing views on what justice is, what et cetera. And it's just, it's a matter of, like, justice is made up of the diversity of all these different views, humanity. It's not made up of like, oh, true justice is divorced from humanity, which is, I think, a thing a lot of people do think. And certainly something that the civil system was able to take advantage of. But it's like, that's not something that you really want. You really do want a lot of different views coming together to form an imperfect but ultimately human kind of
justice. Yeah, it's very much attacking that idea. It's attacking utopian ideals. And it is also very much positing the idea that stress and conflict are what make you a person, and that your struggles and your life have value because there is conflict and stress in it. And what you do doesn't have any value if it's mandated to you or handed to you or a decision that's being made for you as though you're livestock. Like, it only has spiritual, meaningful value, lasting value, if it's a decision that you made on your own terms, in your own time, with your own hands.
Although, and I would say that the show does say that may not be true for everybody, because there are many people who are happy living under Sybil. But the people who aren't, do you just throw them away? Like, you know.
Well, no, I mean, wrong. I felt like it was anti-utopian in saying that, like, there are very, it keeps saying there are very, there are not that many people that can live in this world.
Yeah.
And to wit, and you know, I missed some of these details, but most of the world is just a hell at this point.
Right.
Japan is one of the only places that has rule of law, and it's as a result of having the Sybil system. But they
which
keep
makes
saying,
it look better. Which makes it look better by comparison.
Right.
And why it might be attractive to people.
Yeah. And you know, I appreciated a lot of what the show was trying to say, but I really did approach it. I really did approach the show as though it were more a personal essay than it was like a show. And I'm not saying that that's like different, or it's different, it's not better or worse or anything. I just, that's just how I wound up approaching it, to the point where I got a little impatient with the procedural storytelling because I just wanted to get to the thematic stuff. But that's a plus to me. That's a plus in the show's favor, because that stuff was really fascinating and I really wanted to know what he was going to say.
Yeah, we should like clarify, it isn't just people talking in rooms. There's a lot of that.
No, there's
by
plenty
the
of action
and detective work, but there are like
production IG cyberpunk action. There's plenty of it.
People exploding, robots fighting, etc. Like, there is a lot of that.
It's dark just, and raining and there's neon.
But the minute that it stops, it's people standing in rooms talking about the right way to go about justice and detective work.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, that was the first season, and it was a huge hit, and everyone was like, look at all these intriguing ideas and nice animation and cool character designs and all this stuff. And then they said, we're making season two. There's going to be a – it was confusing for a while because they're like, there's a movie and also season two, but season two is going to come out before the movie, even though that's not in the order in which they were produced.
Right.
And season two is also going to be written by Mr. To Ubukata, mastermind behind such genius as MARDOK Scramble and other such
heroic
works.
Age.
Heroic age.
Le Chevalier Dan.
Chevalier Dan.
Le yes. Chevalier Dan. Yeah, it's a blast from the past. Anyway, think what you will of Tōhoku Bukata. I didn't finish it. I did not finish season two. I was sitting here watching it, and I looked over at you and said, I don't think I can. Why did they even make this? Uh-huh. Why did they even make this if it wasn't going to do anything other than what it's doing right now? And you were like, basically, hold my beer. Like, let me tell you what happens. And I was like,
and then
you know
he stopped
what?
Me. So
I was like, you know what, Jacob?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me what happens in Psycho-Pass season two on the show?
Right.
And we'll discuss the movie as a group. But I need you two to fill me in on. Because when you told me how it concluded, I was like, you're fucking kidding me.
Yeah.
Okay. Please tell me what happens in Psycho-Pass season two, thematically and plot-wise.
Well, plot-wise, it's a little difficult, but I'll do my best.
You can gloss over as much of it as you want.
Blink. I mean, Gabbo's, I assume, like, also looking into the middle distance, like, the plot, I assume.
Okay, so Kogami's gone. So right. Akane's still an inspector, so she gets a new crew enforcers, and there are three of them. Two of them don't matter, and one of them is a creepazoid, not Kogami. Mm-hmm.
Right, so he works out at the same gym that Kogami worked out at.
Right.
He smokes the same cigarettes.
I should clarify, I watched about half of it, mm-hmm. and then I did watch half
you
of the
You got
show.
There before things got really bug nuts.
Yes.
Basically. Like, episode five is the last semi-sane
but
episode.
For
the
podcast's sake, this is helpful. So, mm-hmm. continue.
Okay, so... Yeah, the episode five is the last semi-sane episode of the show, and I think you got to like the beginning of five before it's just.
Yeah.
But like, so anyway, all these new enforcers join the welfare bureau, and their newest like Makishima. Basically, this guy is supposed to be the Makishima to Akane, like it was to Kogami, like. You know, the dark version of Akane, and which is to say that he's like infallible, but he's not like perfectly clear. So Akane's thing, the reason that the system decides to trust her and stuff like that is that she's just has an indomitable spirit. Like her, no matter what stress she's put under, she kind of keeps her cool. And you know,
she's a perfect moral compass.
She's a perfect moral compass. And, you know, very ideal person that I could see possibly existing, but it seems very, very difficult. It was unlikely. It wasn't so out of the pale that she seems impossible, but it, you know. So they wanted to build a version of that, you know, to match her. And that was, so that's this guy named Kirito Kamui. And he is unjudgeable by the system because it just doesn't even give him a number. Like, not zero, not anything. It can't recognize him at all, as if he's a ghost.
You said his name was Kirito Kamui.
I am not shitting you. That's his fucking name.
All right. Isn't that like being named, like, Blade Edge Master
Blade Edge Godface.
Yeah, Blade Edge Godface.
And,
yeah.
Anyway, so, So, he can't be recognized by the system at all, and so he's wreaking havoc and, like, specifically, like, giving people drugs that artificially lower their psychopath number and, like, swapping people's organs and faces to pass them off as famous politicians so he can get into, like, different systems and stuff like that for his master plan. And his master plan is to meet Sybil face-to-face so it can judge him.
Hey, we've done that already.
We have, but, like, this is different because his personality is totally different. So, unlike Makishima, he's very emotional. He cries a lot. He has deep feelings, and he cares about, like, he doesn't want to take apart the system. He wants the system to love him. He's like, Mommy, why won't you love me? And, so, because he can't live in society if it doesn't recognize him. He's unpersoned. He has no identity. And so...
That's not even really ripe thematic ground.
Here's the thing.
It just feels like a situation they came up... Like, well, what could you do with this kind of society conceptually? It's like, well, what if a guy wanted it to love him? And they're like, okay.
Yeah, well, what if it couldn't recognize
him? What if?
Him? What if it couldn't recognize him? And so here's the reason it can't recognize him. You're gonna... I didn't tell you this part. So, he is the reason that the Sybil system exists, because he was an experiment to see... So, they needed to see if they could...
How could he still be alive?
That's...
It's hundreds and hundreds of years... It's like 100 years in the future.
Well, they... Before it used to be actual computers, and they, like, upgraded
yeah,
to brains.
Yeah, they upgraded
to like
psychopathic brains
ago.
Within, like... But here's the thing. So... He,
I don't understand how he could still be alive. That would mean the civil system
he's
took over
zombie.
Society in
he's
like years.
He's a zombie!
That's not the worst issue
okay,
this season.
So,
say what?
Anyway, so here's the thing. So, It was an experiment to see. He's basically
what the fuck?
He's
maybe I should watch this.
He's Frankenstein's monster. He's Frankenstein's monster. They needed to see if they could link together. Let me finish. There's so much more stupid to explain, and I'm never going to get through it all.
So, can I do it?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
They wanted to see if they could link different brains. So there were a bunch of kids who died in a plane crash, and they stitched together the kids' brains. To see
did
it
they show a guy
a
going
person.
Out there like collecting them in a sack?
So he has
and
seven
also
brains.
The kid's body
has...
part. So he, if you, when you really look at him, he's like a patchwork man.
Okay, he's got like yeah, like you zoom in and you can see where they put him together.
Yeah, but so his brain is seven brains, but the other parts like constitute like the combination of seven brains yielded like it's sort of a squaring thing.
That
where
is
he
so
has
dumb.
100. Let me finish. He has 180 personalities or whatever, and so the system can't judge him because now this to me like this bugged me. This doesn't make any sense. So the system I would think would just judge whatever personality is in control at whatever time, right? Like because it's so he's a sane person for the most part. He's one person and occasionally other personalities are shown, but like he's one cohesive person, so this doesn't make any sense, but just assuming it does, like it's like, oh, it just sees him as a bundle of corpses.
Hang on. His brain is stitched together from seven different brains.
Yes.
So one's happy and then there's a grumpy part and then
a sleepy part.
Sleepy.
I wish they'd done that. I wish
Dopey's
they'd done
over
that.
Here. Dopey, I think, is
so stupid.
Maybe more relevant.
I haven't even gotten into the thing. So his
how? Please continue.
Okay, so his plan is to see if Sybil can judge him by coming face to face with it, because in his head, Sybil, the thing that the show decides to revolve around is the omnipotence paradox, which is an outdated thought experiment that has been fucking debunked and like rewritten a million times. But they're like, omnipotence paradox, which if you've never heard it, is if God is omnipotent, can he create a stone that he cannot lift? It's old and it's been fucking torn
to
pieces.
Can God make a pizza so big that even he can't eat it?
Does God know his own death?
Here's the problem with using
it. That thing.
Whoa.
Here's the problem with that. That supposes, so that using that as the center presupposes that Sybil is A, God, which the whole first season was about how that's not true, and B, that it would give a shit that it would, whether it was omnipotent or not. Sybil doesn't care if it's perfect or not. They openly say that in the first season. We know it's not perfect. It's just what we want. We want people to think it's perfect. It's just what the fuck we want because we're a bunch of psychopaths.
Yeah.
And anyway, so, but here's the whole show
is a brain box full of madmen.
It's a brain box full of madmen who just happen to have no emotions, so they criminalize emotion. That's it. And so, but this whole show presupposes that they actually give a shit about what's fair. And so this guy shows up. And they're like, oh, I guess that is unfair that, like, we don't judge ourselves because we're a collective entity. We're also a Frankenstein, except we're a digital Frankenstein that was based on your success as a biological Frankenstein. It's not fair that we don't judge ourselves either. So then they judge themselves and, like, eliminate the brains they like the least, I guess, which doesn't make any sense. And then they get rid of him. And the whole time you have a fucking side plot that was based literally on the fucking movie Psycho, where a Norman Bates-like character runs around with an obsession for his mother. He's the new Kogami is a Norman Bates-like character who has the highest recorded crime coefficient ever, which means he's the most. So here's the thing.
These are some Tohu Bukata ideas.
He acts like a psychopath. He acts like somebody who has no
like a blade licking cackling.
Yeah. And but so they're like, but he has the highest ever recorded crime coefficient. So I'm like,
apparently,
so he's just,
is it 666?
Fucking, I don't know.
420.
That would be good. But no.
That's not that high.
And so...
That's my crime coefficient.
It'd be great. You'd be kill on sight, though.
Yep.
He's too dank. We have to kill him on sight. Anyway, the whole thing revolves... Basically, the whole thing is summed up as and relies on the idea that Sybil is an inherently good thing and that people would want their crime coefficients to be low. So the whole thing basically revolves around the idea that Sybil could be more fair or, like, isn't perfect. And it's like a gotcha that, like, nobody was interested in gotcha-ing. It's like, we know it's not fair. It's literally a box full of psychopaths. What the fuck are you on about? And
it feels like he didn't watch the first season.
Well, he did, and he just didn't understand it. He came away from it thinking, this does make sense. And it's like, he is so angry at you. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
I was reading interviews in preparation for this, and I literally found a part where Urobuchi corrects Ubukata on Sybil being infallible, and it just goes right over his head. And he's like, yes, it's infallible.
And Urobuchi means, you mean it wants people to think it's infallible. Yes, that's what I meant. And he's like, no, it's not. We saw what you wrote.
Yeah.
And it's so, but along the way, of all that madness, they have shit like illegal, like this just totally to the side, and why would you even put that in here? Like, illegal aliens being turned into Five Nights at Freddy's animal animatronics for the purposes of entertaining the idle rich.
So fucked.
It's so terrible.
Mommy murdering puppies.
And turning the use of military drones into with holographic technology into a kid's video game so that the kids are secretly murdering people and they don't even know it with a remote game.
Wasn't that a Orphan Black episode?
Probably.
These all sound like Orphan Black episodes.
And it's
they also make a minor character from the first season into the worst thing ever. Into like the show Scrappy Doo, and she is totally unlikable.
Mm-hmm. She makes a cameo appearance. Remember the really bitchy inspector with the ponytail who doesn't like Akane? So she is the Scrappy Doo of season two, where she just like her entire role is to do everything as unlikable as possible. And it just feels like the show is dumping on her constantly. Also, that show is really misogynistic too. Like women get a bad fucking rap in that. Even Akane.
From Toe Ubukata, you say?
let's sweep that under the rug. Anyway, it's a fucking hot mess, and people hated it. Like
they really hated it.
People,
I mean, there was some backlash. Like you were trashing it pretty hard.
Yeah, well, there was initially, but like as time passed, like more of the "it's good" did kind of fade and fade hard. Like people really came back on that show pretty hard. So it was interesting. It was interesting to see the time. Basically, like, I say that because so we published. I had my episode reviews, and people reacted. Divisive. Some people were like, "Oh God, you're right. This sucks." And there were people, "No, it's good." By the time we had a full series review out, like a year later, 100% of the feedback was, "This is terrible," and I hated it.
Yeah,
and it was
people
interesting.
Really. People eventually agreed with you. Yeah.
Not, I mean, if you like it, you like it. That's totally fine. But I'm just saying, like, it was one of those things where the backlash was like savage. It was very angry.
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't waste time watching the second season, but that sounds really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Thing is, though, like, I just know it. Like, we're going to be watching an M. Night Shyamalan movie, and you're going to get to the end, and he'll be like, "I'm actually seven brains stitched together." And we'll be like,
it's
been done.
That's a good description of it. It feels like an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's terrible. So season two it flopped, right?
It sold a fraction of what the other one sold, but it did sell.
It did sell?
It sold kind of like
how did the
like
movie
The movie did really well.
So they're going to make more Psycho Pass.
I'm sure they want to.
Maybe.
It's been a couple of years
at this point.
Yeah, I think their biggest issue now is like, do we bring him back on or not? He's not interested. Is he interested? I think that's probably their biggest. Because like, Tobuo Bukata was not a good fit for the material. Like, yes, it sold, but it like sold a fraction of the other one, and people did not like it. So I don't think they want to. I think they want to bring the other writer back. You know, they're like, oh, this is probably kind of important to the success of this. So,
Yeah.
But he sold his soul to puppets, so.
He sold his soul to puppets, so.
Yeah, he's in love with those puppets.
He loves them puppets.
All right, so let's talk about the film. Psycho Pass movie came out a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. When did it come out? 2015? 2016?
2015.
This was completed before the series came out?
Yeah, they were produced simultaneously, and technically the movie was completed before season two.
So I liked the movie. You described it in your review for ANN as like a jump movie, which means to say that like it feels important, but really nothing changes at all about the world, or like the characters change a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's
big stakes,
it's a
small impact.
Yeah, it's a big, it's a standalone sort of essay on let's apply the Sybil system to foreign policy. As a 2-hour exercise, and here's what Gen Urobuchi thinks would happen in this scenario. I thought it was pretty interesting. I was let down by the ending. again, I thought it didn't quite give me what I really sort of wanted from it, which I'll get into a little later. But so the film, I guess I'll describe the film. There's everything. You don't need to watch season two at all. Mm-hmm. I didn't notice what they were referencing from season two. It wouldn't matter. Basically, they send a flotilla with a Sybil system on it and park it off the coast of...
Toot toot.
Yeah, they park it off the coast of, was it like Myanmar or something like that? Thailand?
Cambodia, yeah. I think.
Cambodia. Okay. The idea is that this is a failed state. Japan has propped up a dictator and has provided him with the Sybil system, drones, and not enforcers, but robots and guns and stuff to spread the Sybil system throughout his state and bring it together and unify the state, turn it into a functioning government. Mm-hmm. There are military rebels that are fighting a war against this dude. And Akane is sent overseas to find Kogami, who is captured on video assisting with some of these rebels. Basically, some terrorists from the country show up in Japan to get revenge. Where have I seen that before? And they notice, they get the information through these rebels that Kogami was part of this group or attached to it. And so she goes over there to find Kogami, and they uncover this whole scheme, this whole plot. And in the end, it is extremely ham-fisted commentary about colonialism, colonization. Imperialism. You can swap in the U.S. for Japan and the Middle East for Cambodia, and it's a one-to-one allegory for... The U.S. propping up dictators in the Middle East, and then there being horrible unintended consequences as a result of that fact, and the society collapsing.
And then our military comes in with, well, I guess you couldn't handle it. I guess we're going to have to fix it, which was...
Right. And then, well, I guess you couldn't put this together, so we better take care of it. And that's pretty much the story. I thought it was maybe going to go into a little bit more other stuff, but it is literally just a thought exercise. What if Sybil system in failed state... And in a society that has been racialized, so a society that functions on some level in class and race, which wasn't really talked about in the first season. Like,
Japan, which
honestly was kind of, it felt like, based on the kind of science fiction he was writing, a little bit easy mode for a writing standpoint. Like, you could write this fictional universe from a standpoint of a homogenous society, and that's easier to write than, let's put the as an American looking at the Sybil system, I'm fucking like, what? There's no way I would be able to fit in with that. And everybody thinks they're too much of an individual to fit in to that kind of a thing, because that's just how we're socialized, that we're American. So I was eager to see it applied to some other situation, and the movie gave me that, and I did think it was pretty interesting. I was confused by some of the choices, but I did like the movie. I thought it was – I was really invested in it. There was a moment where I was like, I'm so existentially terrified by this threat that I really buy into the urgency in this movie. I feel for this country, because even if it is a war-torn hellscape where they are fighting for their own lives, that seems better than the human spirit rolling in and getting just crushed under the Sybil system.
Right.
Like, it does seem better that they would hash it out themselves rather than being smashed by this foreign power. At least that's what it seemed like to me. I don't know. What did you think?
Well, I think, just like the first season, I think Urobuchi is maybe kind of saying, well, it depends on your values.
Yeah.
Because there are people who would be happy under the Sybil system, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, just like there wouldn't be anything wrong with psychopathy if it was if you didn't commit crimes, you know? You know, there are functioning, like, non-criminalized psychopaths in the world. They just they have to deal with the deficiency that they have, you know? But I think, like, his conclusion that they would adopt the Sybil system even if it was
voluntary. Yeah, so it's got this cynical little coda on the end where it's like, oh, you want to have a democratic vote, huh? And then, well, that's fine with me. And then it happens, and then, oh, look, they voted him back
in. They voted in the Sybil system, So,
all right, Urobuchi.
Well, you know, that's fair. And I don't want to throw out, so I wouldn't be happy living under the Sybil system either, but I don't want to throw out, I think it's fundamentally a wicked system, but I don't think it is utilitarian. And the reason utilitarian has the word utility in it is because it does serve some positive purposes. You know, I don't believe in it. I think it's
you're
wicked.
Choosing what you're saying in that instance, philosophically anyway, you are choosing this idea that a lack of emotion and a detachedness from being detached from your emotions somehow makes you a superior judge, a superior person, a person who is more fit to be in command or in control.
Which I don't
think is true. Is not true. Uh-huh. It's not true. Being impulsive and acting on your emotions.
I should clarify. I'm not defending the system. I think the civil system is terrible. I'm just saying, like, I don't think that the idea that it takes over this failed state is supposed to be inherently, like, tragic. I think it just is. I think Urobuchi is saying this just is.
It just is, weigh
the positives and negatives of it, and you can just look
I mean, he makes an argument. Like, there's a post-colonialist thread through this whole thing. There's a mercenary who's sitting there reading this post-colonialist thinker.
He's reading Fanon and Sartre.
So he sets up this kind of titanic philosophical combat thing that ultimately doesn't really materialize, which is one of the reasons I was a little disappointed on it.
The movie is more action-focused than the show is.
Yeah, which is to be expected.
They do prioritize action. What were you going to say, Gabo?
I was wondering, Zach, were you saying that you wouldn't find it realistic that they would vote the system in?
No, I was saying that's a very sort of expected, cynical take that I feel like I would hear on a podcast, and it's just very expected. Yes, it is very realistic. It's just a little eye-rolly cynical, that's all.
The movie's not subtle. It is like hammer blows, here's the history of colonialism. So you get the expected result in all these cases.
I think that last scene was my least favorite part of the movie because it was so hammered down on the Akane work with the system. The system's like, haha, you're not going to beat me stuff.
Yeah. Which, you know,
She walks through the hologram of Shambhala and it literally crumbles around her. When she talks about how it's a false piece. Like,
I mean,
hilarious.
This is a show and a series that's so unsubtle that the characters just carry around the books that they're talking about.
I've been reading Conrad.
I've been sitting here reading this and it seems relevant to the show that I am in.
It's like, I hear you're thinking about hunting down Makishima and like coming to a conflict of values with him. What you reading? Heart of Darkness.
I think at one point the Makishima and Kogami are reading the same book in hardcover, like the same edition, just by coincidence.
That's Heart of Darkness, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Hang on a second. Let me find these. Let's get to some Twitter questions. But Gabo, tell me what you thought of the film and what did you expect from it and how did you feel about it?
I just saw it yesterday. I expected a civil system on foreign policy thoughts, civil system on colonialism, and that's what I got, plus some action. This was my return to the series. I watched this before I rewatched parts of season 2 and 1. So I think I was more positive than both of you because I was just like happy to be back with Psycho Pass.
Oh, that's right. Cool.
And didn't realize how much I like miss these characters and their dynamics and just like Bucci's writing. So I enjoyed it a lot. I recognize a lot of the same problems you do, but it was also
I liked the film.
It was like a piece of cake after a long time of not watching Bucci.
Yeah, I agree with you, Gabo, that like rather than just thought exercises, which it is a lot of that. I don't feel like the characters are purely thought exercises. I do think of them as people for the most part. Like they're exaggerations of people, but like. I did resonate with them and relate to them. Like, I feel like I liked Ginoza a lot, and I liked his struggle a lot because it was like, I'm trying to do the best I can, and everybody keeps abandoning me. And I felt like that must be tough in a society that, like, basically isolates people to begin with, kind of treats them like, empathy isn't really important and don't think about things. Like, Ginoza is doing his best to keep his crime coefficient low, which is difficult in his situation, while everybody's abandoning him, which is going to make it go up. Like, that's really hard and that sucked. And so, like, I felt like, you know, like, that was a very human story. And also, Kagari, who is not a super important character, but his arc is basically, I was like, that's exactly what would happen to me, which is at age 5, he gets labeled a latent criminal. He gets thrown in the pokey, and then he takes any opportunity to get out, which is to become an enforcer, becomes a hedonist, becomes way too curious, gets killed for being curious. So I was like, that's probably what would happen to me. So I felt for him just on a level of like, but I, you know, that would be my life, I think, probably.
I liked all the characters a lot. I thought it was very emotional. But that's pretty much a Bucci thing, like marrying like a lot deep thoughtfulness with like great humanity, like rooting them in great empathy for all the people, including Makishima, who in most to most people's evaluations would be a monster. No, he's just a person who was pushed to this because he was discarded.
Right. His brain don't work good.
I really do appreciate Urobuchi's attitude towards humanity, which is very much embracing the whole thing, like the whole thing,
the
high and the low, mm-hmm. and saying that you need to find balance between these two things to be a well-rounded, good person. I appreciate that. And like the show, I mean, I'm sitting here talking about sort of my issues with it, but that's only because I'm talking to two people who are huge fans and this is a discussion. But I really liked those 11 episodes that they were very thoughtful and it gave me a lot to sit there and think about. And although I was a little impatient with it, I really enjoyed the experience and I did really like the movie, although I had some issues with it. But any great writer, I'm going to read his book and be like, this is really interesting. And then it makes me think about the issues I had with it. And like, that's just how I engage with stuff.
Yeah.
But it was a fascinating show. And I thought it was really interesting. I did view it, the whole thing, as kind of a vision of the future from 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I would really be interested. So here's what I want. This is my dream.
Mm-hmm.
I want Urobuchi to write a movie that is a prequel that tells us how the Sybil system came to power, how it took over society, how that happened, what happened to the rest of the world, and how Japan developed into the Sybil system. Starting right now, starting in 2017.
Right.
So in our current political situation, because I feel like a lot of people maybe have a different idea about things than they did 5 years ago, now in 2017. I want something that's written with hindsight, with modern current hindsight, that explains how society got taken over by something that to me feels fundamentally unhuman. That feels like an inhuman control system. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, an inhuman control system. I mean, fundamentally extremely human control system. And that's what I want.
What we thought of as an
anti-emotion.
Chart the history getting to this point. And I feel like not only would that answer like a lot of my huge questions, because I'm sitting there watching this going, but that doesn't account for... But you know, like I had like a lot of issues with it being plausible based on my understanding, my feelings about humanity in 2017. But I feel like if you showed this to me in 2012, I probably would have felt a little differently about it. I'm just, you know, the world's changed a lot since then. And I sort of want this same material, but with the advantage of being written right now.
Yeah.
And what I really want is that arc of history before. And I would like to see someone tackle a hypothetical, what happens if they got rid of it? How would they get rid of it? How would it come down? You know, that would be interesting to me to see. Right. Because the minute the second season launched into more procedurals, I didn't care. I cared about the thematic stuff. And when you take that out, there's nothing interesting about it to me anymore. Yeah. And literally, like, the second episode or something.
Make a rock so heavy he can't lift it.
The second season, the second episode is like, but how could the Sybil system not track someone? And you're like, we just went through this.
We know.
We just went through this, you fuckers. So, yeah.
I think, what was I going to say? Oh, I mean, like, so, you know, there's no one answer and you need a little bit of details in there. But I think what Akane says is as, like, the method that she hopes to get rid of the system with is she comes up with, to me, the thesis statement of the show, if you can boil it down to one thing, which is really difficult to do, but if you can, she says the law does not protect people must protect the law. It doesn't exist to protect people. It doesn't.
Yeah, the law doesn't exist on its own. It doesn't exist for its own sake. Mm-hmm. It's not enforcing itself. Mm-hmm. It has to serve a purpose.
Yeah. So
back to the utilitarian thing.
Mm-hmm. And so I think what her goal is to, in order to dismantle the system, is to bring up and to educate a populace into believing that it is their job to want to protect the law, basically to enforce their own values and assert individualism in their own, instead of just, I'll let Sybil handle it, you know, basically to enforce those values and feelings in people so that they will. Now, this is going to cause turmoil, but it would eventually, hopefully, lead to enough of a population that would, when the secret behind Sybil is revealed, would go, oh, I don't want that. I don't like that. And, like, get rid of it. So, you know, how do you go about doing that? How you go about engendering empathy and a sense of justice in people? Don't know, but, you know.
Yeah.
I'd also like to contest the idea that's no longer relevant in 2017.
I don't think it's not relevant at all. I just think it's more a philosophical argument than a directly relevant to right now. Like, it feels more philosophical to me.
I also disagree with that.
All right.
I won't get too much into the political situation right now, which I'll just say is explosive and seems to have – it seems like a lot of things have blown up since 2012. But I find that this show is still engaging with current event stuff that is very relevant, if only quieter. And it sort of struck me when I was rewatching it. If you look at Sybil as a metaphor for an algorithm – you know, like, algorithm discourse of, like, are these algorithms neutral and things like that?
Yeah, right.
Well, think about it, like, where the deal is that there are a lot of questions right now over whether these, like, algorithms that are increasingly being used from things like what helping you or, like, telling you what things to buy based on your previous preferences or even, like, crime mapping or crime prediction, which is literally psychopaths, are neutral or not because they take on the image of neutrality, of being a science, of being objective predictors, when really they inherit the emotional or loaded, culturally loaded motivations of their creators, which tend to replicate like the people who are already in power.
Business interests, corporate interests, you know.
But yeah, that's, no, that's a good point.
That's an extremely relevant thing right now that's happening quietly and that I think is contributed in many different ways to the explosive events of the past few years. And I can see, and I think that if you were to track sort of how the Sybil system came to be, that would be a huge component of it. And it is kind of the point that it is quiet, that it masks itself in...
I think part of the reason I didn't necessarily follow it down that road is because it's presented as a system of government. And so I just didn't really, you know, think about it in terms of like, oh, right, the algorithms that are coming to control us all, that kind of thing. I guess I didn't quite think about it in those terms. I was thinking about it more in terms of government and how people govern themselves and systems of control for society that are explicit and overt rather than something like an algorithm, which is more insidious and kind of under the surface, but it comes to take over everything, basically.
I hadn't considered that, but when you think about American politics specifically, like think about the factors that led to the outcome of the election, and people talk about targeted algorithms in terms of like
the news were shown,
what people accepted as the true news, which was not.
Yeah. So a movie exploring all this stuff, would be especially timely and cool, hopefully.
I also think it may be a bit of a burden to ask Bucci to justify how we got here. It'd be interesting, but this is also, I think especially if you were gonna ask like what comes after the system, that would be asking for his own utopia, like his own idea of how this would develop into the perfect system, which means he'd have to develop like his ideal system when this is in large part about taking it down. Of that, taking down the idea of that being even possible,
right? Well, I mean, like it doesn't necessarily.
People striving.
If you want to give it a happy ending, you would have to take it down and have an ambiguous ending, I guess.
It doesn't have to conclude in utopia at all, but you could have a very strong statement that no, human civilization is messy, dictated by emotions in most cases. Like this is how it goes, how it has to go. People will not accept anything other than this, and you could make that point. You know?
I think. It's also difficult because this show has a burden of being about current events.
Right.
So that would be saying how this would end ideally to him or how he thinks it would end or how it should end would essentially be an attempt at predicting the future.
Sure.
Because this hasn't worked out yet. And that is a risky proposition.
Yeah. And all I'm saying is I'd be interested to see it. That's all.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know that it would exist or not. I would just be interested in seeing it. And I acknowledge that it would be a horrible writing challenge. And I know it would be really tough. I'm just saying I would like to see it. I'm not saying it should exist to justify the existence of psychopaths or anything like that. I'm just saying those are the questions that I had. That's what I find interesting. I would just like to see it. That's all. So let's get to some of these Twitter questions, shall we? All right. Rosebrook 18 wants to know, did your perceptions of any of the characters change drastically over the course of the series? I mean, they're supposed to. A bit.
I only caught the second half of that question.
Did your perceptions of any of the characters change drastically over the course of the series?
Yeah, I mean, they are supposed to, definitely. I think the biggest example is Makishima goes from being like, oh, he's the bad guy, to like, there are things worse than Makishima. Mm. Like, you know, yeah. You go like, what's, if depending on your value system, like, what's more evil, Makishima or the Sybil system? And it's like, I believe the show wants you to deduce that Makishima is not as evil. And, you know, that's certainly interesting on its own.
Yeah. Makishima is a victim. Not to say that it excuses all of the horrible things he did, but he should have been treated well.
Right.
Right. Sasquatchulus wants to know, is Spooky Boogie the best username?
No.
No.
It's Gabomatic.
Excellent answer.
I saw a username earlier today, Chris Pistofferson. And I thought that was pretty clever.
It's good.
Pretty clever. Mm-hmm. All right. Mech Anime Review wants to know, how would you compare this to anything Ghost in the Shell? Well, I mean, that's what it's attempting to sort of ape. So, you know, that was the model, right?
Yeah. I think they're concerned with very different things. At least if you're talking
about it's just a model. Complex. It's just a model. It's like, hey, you like a four-door sedan, but the inside's totally different and it drives totally different and it's a different car, but it's also a four-door sedan. You know, I don't know. Like, it's a shitty metaphor. It is a car metaphor. What's that, Kevin?
Well, Psycho Pass has this great, like, dystopian art design and, like, great, like, artistic representations of what feels like a realistic future or has felt like a realistic future over the past 20 years. Its thematic preoccupations are very, what is the soul when computers?
Hmm.
Which is, it's very inward. It's not actually that concerned with society. Right. To a stretchment, I feel, because I feel like the environmental design and like the little bits when it gets into society are the much stronger and more interesting and even like the more long-lasting things about Ghost in the Shell, because that's what you remember mostly, the imagery, more than beep, boop, what is soul?
Yeah.
While Psycho Pass is not concerned with that. That's the problem the second season made of making it about like the actual like mechanics that were never really that explained very well and even repudiated of what is this god machine.
But how could he judge a brain if it was seven brains?
Yeah. It's concerned with society. It's concerned with governance. It's concerned with a very concrete worldly problems and not these kind of abstract, these like philosophical rabbit holes that may not be relevant because honestly, AI isn't even close to making like to replicating a consciousness.
Right. Well, that's a good lead into the next question from Schrodinger's Matt. What elements of Psycho Pass's future would you say are closest to and furthest from becoming reality? Well, what you were talking about with our algorithm future, that's probably the closest thing, but that's sort of a cousin of what's sort of being discussed in this show, so I'm not sure that's, you know, particularly relevant, but... I mean,
like, if you look through the news, like, it's kind of funny, like, everyone from LC is like, this is actual Psycho Pass with, like, they're introducing, like, robot cops in different places. There are crime predictive algorithms. It's like I saw this play out badly in an anime a few years ago.
Right.
And movies and stuff.
Furthest part away is probably the explodey guns are, like, sewing brains together.
Sewing brain.
Yeah.
E-books, that's it. That's e-libraries where there's no physical books. That's the answer to that question.
Koraz923 wants to know, does the idea that Urobuchi tends to use the same character archetypes in all of his stuff apply beyond Kagami, Akane, and Makishima?
Yes. Ginoza is Sayaka / who was that character in Fate Zero? It's been a long time since I've
Lancer, the Armulator, or whatever.
Yeah. Yes, the answer is yes. Kagari is Kyoko, and all these things map pretty reliably.
No, wait.
Was that wrong?
Ginoza was Karya, right?
I think
that makes Kagari sense to me.
The hypocritical one, yeah. As I say, I couldn't remember the Fate examples, so you had to tell me. But, like, because it's been a while since I've seen it, it's hard to keep all this stuff straight. But he tends to map on a... sort of a, I don't know, he tends to write his stuff. So none of these characters are the same in personality or like what the show is about, theme, anything like that. The way he tends to map the characters, the way they tend to overlap is he tries to write characters in terms of morality and reason and balancing those two things. So if you're like a moral person, but you lack reason, then you're a hypocrite. Bad things are going to happen. Some of the times the worst things happen to those people. And if you have high in reason and low in morality, then you're, you know, like, then you're utilitarian and you're evil for that reason. And he sort of balances these things out and along sort of different lines. And so he comes up with, even though the shows are about completely different things and the archetypes are different, like Ginoza's personality is nothing like Sayaka. You end up with characters that meet similar fates and represent similar viewpoints in completely different contexts. So, you know.
The general triangle is Booch self-insert, who's usually, like, dark and has guns.
Yes.
Like, and has guns. More idealistic version of him, like a pedestalized, like, version that he wants to exist but doesn't really believe ultimately can but still wants to put up there, which is usually a woman. Mm-hmm. And Bucci's dark instincts.
Which is like a monster character, you know.
Or yeah.
That's the triangle, and then beyond that, the side characters are all those other little things I mentioned. The Ginoza Sayaka Karya type is always the one I'm the most interested in. I don't know why. I think that just that kind of hypocrisy is just inherently interesting to me. So
the Kagari is like the victim.
Do what?
The Kagari is like the tragic victim of the system. Yeah, who's just trying their best.
Who says, I'll do what you want me to do, and it'll be okay, right? And it's not okay. Yeah. He tends to use these archetypes, but it's not, like, predictable. Like, his stories aren't predictable, and it isn't, like, the same thing happens over and over. It's just how he tends to think about human nature, I guess. So, you know.
All right. AngelXO3 wants to know, anyone bummed out that Yayoi's backstory felt so separate from the rest of the series instead of being used to set up future story arcs?
At least she got an episode.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that you wish would be continued. That's like, this is kind of a show where you kind of end up being like, I wish I knew what would happen next. Interestingly, her episode was the only one not written by Bucci and Makoto Fukami.
Yeah, it was written by a third party, according to Bucci, because he said, quote, I didn't think that I could believably write that perspective, by which I think he means a lesbian. So, you know, he had somebody else write that one because it's from perspective of character he didn't feel like he could really write the inner thoughts and arc of. Which is fair. It doesn't really make a big difference. It fits into the series just fine. But
if you research a psychopath, there's just some cool, nice perspectives on like gay issues. Like it said, this is a Japan where that's all been legalized, and like Yayoi looks back and kind of mystified by a time when it wasn't allowed and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And yet, it is also the thing that causes her crime coefficient to go up enough to where she is stress detained because of this conflict over her feelings for this person. So even if it's legalized, like that doesn't negate the personal psychological distress that somebody might feel from like desire that they feel they can't have or a struggle over ideology. Like she's an approved band and this is a disapproved band and she's not supposed to you know hang out with them, which is also kind of a metaphor for her.
I think I misinterpreted that scene. I missed that everything like gay marriage had been legalized and that all that stuff was just legal.
That's in some interview. It wasn't.
Oh,
that's in like side materials.
That seems really
sure
relevant because it changes that episode. I thought that's why she got stressed out.
I mean, it's part of it. Like that's the thing. Here, even if stuff is legalized, it's hard to come out regardless of how legal something is.
If this is like 100 years from now, and how long has it been? Like, see, this is what I want to know. Like,
no,
100 years from now, they get a date.
People who've been through it, no, it doesn't matter. You could have like the whole gay kid coming out thing. Like, my parents are extremely liberal; they had no problem with gay issues, and I still like could not come out for years. Like, it's a personal thing.
Yeah, but you can't
the distress.
But if you're talking about a hypothetical society where all of that stuff has been totally legal and accepted by normal society for generation after for at least 2 or 3 generations. Would you still feel a tremendous amount of anxiety about...
I mean, she also feels a lot of anxiety because the girl she likes is an illegal musician.
Exactly. There's
that. There you go.
But it's,
and so it's that, I think it is not both, the gay stuff.
I think it is both of those things.
Here's, it's kind of a metaphor for it at the same time.
Yeah,
while making it legal.
Not if it's explicitly legal.
No. Well, it wasn't made explicitly.
It's a failed metaphor then.
No. You don't
That's like
understand.
The emotions of it.
I don't think you understand this one. But like, it's, yeah, like, even if stuff isn't accepted in society, like, it's accepted to be a nerd. You don't, it's not something necessarily.
No, we're very oppressed people.
No, we're not oppressed. We're not oppressed. It's just, it's not necessarily something that you're proud of or that you broadcast. Like, it is a thing that can cause you stress. I'm saying, like, and it's not comparable to that, but that just makes that all the more drastic. And that it can definitely cause psychological distress. Like, that's a thing that's been analyzed for a long time. Self-loathing, you know, even in accepted society.
Sure, sure. I don't know. I'm just asking questions. Yeah. Sorry.
Although, this is going to bring up the grim specter of, do we talk about the rather popular and, I think, really interesting theory that Kogami is gay? Do we bring that up? Because that's interesting to me.
The only, the only time he ever says anything is he tells the big boob chain smoking scientist lady that's in all of these shows that she's not as tight.
Right. That's not really the reason, but that is interesting.
But she's gay.
And
she's fine.
Right? She's everything. Yes.
Because I thought maybe that's a joke, but they only ever show her sleeping with the one lady, right?
No, but she says explicitly that
she's
bi.
She's okay. Pan or whatever.
So what's the theory? How do they back it up?
He is extremely longing, like, and, like, romantically and sexually framed, like, relationships with men. Makishima and his old, like, partner who died.
His partner's the biggest thing. So, like, if you watch it and you don't really look at it with that lens, I think one of the weakest things about the show is Kogami getting really obsessed with the death of his partner, who we don't really know, and, like, nobody seems to have a lot of positive things to say about.
But he loved him.
Well, it's not really explicit. It's hard to say, because here's the thing. So she asks, there is one scene where they really go into his feelings on the guy, because otherwise it's just mad that he's dead. And it's like, well, what did he even mean to you? So,
kill my partner.
Yeah, exactly. And so manly feelings. But like, Akane asks him, well, what was he like? And Kogami proceeds to describe nothing but negative traits. He's like,
yeah,
well,
he was a womanizing drunk.
He was a womanizing drunk who was like a loose cannon, blah blah blah. And he's like, he wasn't really good for anything, but I sort of admired. He's like, it's the kind of he's the kind of guy I kind of wish I could have or be. But which is weird to say, because his personal values, like his personal morals, don't match up with his partner. We see his partner, like, explicitly has different, completely different values from him. So what does he mean by, like, this is the kind of person that I wish, you know, that I wish I could be around more or whatever? And it's like, that's such a bizarre thing to say. And so, like, that lended to that, along with the framing of Makishima as this sort of weird romantic thing. I don't think Kogami is romantically interested in him, but they are put together in a shippy way rather deliberately, and it's like, well, why is this the case? And I think it's like, is it he fears this aspect of himself? You know, it's mysterious, perhaps on purpose. And then the biggest thing is, so it was revealed in an interview that when Urobuchi was consulted on Psychopass 2, and the guy who's, like, not Kogami, the evil Kogami who shows up, they were like, oh, yeah, when we were developing him, so Ubukata says this. He said, when we were developing him, you really wanted him to be, like, gay, right? And he said, oh, yeah, I didn't think you guys took that idea. And he's like, well, no, I guess we didn't, but I remember that being in the... And he said, I went with that subtextually, you know, because he's, like, twisted or whatever. Fucking.
He's, like, badass Norman Bates.
Yeah, and it's like, but I remember that being your direction. And he said, well, I understand that you didn't go that direction, but that was, you know, that was my suggestion, yeah. And it's like, so the not Kogami, he explicitly wanted, Urobuchi wanted him to be gay. So it's like, But anyway, it's all pie in the sky. There's absolutely no confirmation one way or the other in the show, but it's fun to think about as a, you know. So it's just funny.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I think there's... Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's fine.
All right. Well, this is a good question. Schrodinger's Matt also wants to know, rank the Urobuchi sequels, Psychopass 2, Fate Stay Night, Unlimited Blade Works, and Madoka Rebellion. Yes, I know their circumstances differ wildly. Well, look, everyone would put Psychopass 2 at the bottom, right?
Right.
So the question is, what's better, Madoka Rebellion or Fate Stay Night?
Madoka.
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 It's
the thing is, like, the more I think about that Madoka movie, the less I liked what it did with the characters and the direction it went. And it felt unnecessary. Like, the more I think about the ending of that movie, I'm like, why did they do that?
It's totally unnecessary.
I think it's just extraneous, and it was a commission, and he was like, I gotta write this, but it's this is the only thing I could do, so I'll do it. Uh-huh. It's the only thing that kind of made sense, and it ruins the ending. It makes the ending of the show really a downer. Mm-hmm. When it wasn't before, but there wasn't anything else to do, but he was commissioned to write it, and it's competently written for what it is. Well, Fate Stay Night, I have many thoughts on Fate Stay Night.
It's the best to me because it is the most, so I agree, it's totally unnecessary. I don't think it like does anything with Monica that wasn't like kind of already addressed or whatever, but like,
I don't get me wrong, I really like the way that movie looks. I enjoyed the act of watching it, like, just the ending.
Yeah.
I loved the ending of Madoka.
Right.
It didn't need to be undone for dark, cynical. Come on.
Yeah, no.
All right.
But, I guess I find it more interesting. Not more interesting. I liked it more than Fate Stay Night because.
We should podcast on that sometime. Rebellion.
Fate Stay Night is. I don't know. I understand what it has to say, and it's just not that interesting to me. And Rebellion, like.
What is a hero?
A miserable pile of nonsense.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Rebellion, even though I don't like what it added to the show, it is interesting on a metatextual level. I guess that's what's interesting to me about it is the story behind it and it's like an end of Evangelion, basically. Like, in a lot of ways, it's an end of Evangelion to the Evangelion TV series ending. And so on that level, it's just interesting to talk about and discuss, whereas Fate Stay Night, it is not as interesting to discuss. But, there's merit in both of those things. Psychopath 2 is just a waste of everybody's time. But,
again, these things exist because shareholders wanted them to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Although Fate Stay Night technically came before.
Technically, that's
not all three of them. Two of them exist because shareholders wanted them to exist. Let's see here. Last couple questions here. Lawrence Green, do you think the series is stronger by never fully depicting any kind of romance in Akane's life? I don't think the story has space for it.
Mm-hmm.
The story just wouldn't have space for a romance of any kind.
She has feelings, but, you know.
It's hinted at, but that's it.
That's about it.
That's all there's time for.
Yeah.
If they tried to tack a romance on, it would have just been, because then it would have had to have been at least somewhat about that. And it just, that's not what Urobuchi's interested in. But
don't you want it to be like in Psychopath 2 where she actively pines for Kogami, is shown naked a lot, and she comes to her detective conclusions by having the ghost of Kogami in her head tell her what to do. That is what happens because Ubukata is a fucking pig. Anyway.
All right.
That's what happens,
Let's move on to the next question. Wizard of Sneebs asks, using the techno-thriller action series to dissect political realities, i.e. social control, is fraught. Can something criticizing the current political situations of Japan get broadcast in the studio system? Can pulp be used for real-world political dissent? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean...
It's all the time. Shin Godzilla!
Psychopass isn't the first one trying to do this or doing this. That has been a thing that people have been attempting with various success. Some of it very well since the beginning of film.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But, anime is more political now, I think, than ever. You get a lot of political anime now. That's commentative on at least some sort of social or political situation. I don't mean broadly, the whole show is about politics. Uh-huh. I just mean I've seen plenty and, lots of commentary in anime about the generational divide and, it's like a Terror in Resonance. There you go. Shows like that.
Yeah. Well, what
gotcha men crowds.
Isn't the popular criticism of anime now that it is less, that it's more, commodified and less what's the word? It's saying less. Isn't that kind of the popular? I disagree with it, but you could
say that, but I'm just saying that even the light novels that are getting adapted are still have political themes in them. Gate, irregular at Magic High School. I'm just naming shows here that are all political.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Attack on Titan
has political themes in it. No, Boruto is not political.
Uh-huh.
Okay, neither is really Recreators, but even Recreators is doing at least a little bit of social, a tiny little, teeny little bit of social commentary.
And fucking Black Lagoon definitely was.
You can't make that much anime and only do pure escapism. Uh-huh. You can't make 40 shows a season that are just meaningless escapism. That's just not not how art works.
Right.
Even commercial art barely works like that. Mm-hmm. You know, people have to write something.
Right.
So I think almost just by sheer virtue of volume there's a lot of, there's plenty of stuff now.
Light novel volume after light novel volume.
Angel of Dust in the chat points out that I've seen a lot of commentative anime, particularly since Abe took power. Yeah. Yep.
There you go.
And if you want to go into the deep dive of whether it's even possible to criticize the system using the system's own.
Like, yeah, sure.
Tools, that's like, another day. Go ahead. It's, that yeah. is fraught terrain.
Fraught.
Have fun.
Danger wants to know, any word on what Gen thought of S2, season 2? I mean, we discussed it. Yeah, he's been very nice about it.
Yeah.
Let's see here. This is the final question from I Have No Culottes, which is a really good name. No Culottes. Short culottes. For I Have No Culottes. Uh-huh. What's your crime coefficient? I mean, I already took the best one. Mine is 420, but Jacob, go ahead.
Jake is 666. I'm 69.
Yours is the only one that would keep you
You're
in society.
You're the only one who's allowed to fucking function. You've been in therapy, but... No, I mean, like, geez. To answer the question, attempt it sincerely as... I think it's well beneath... I think it's between 50 and 100. I think it's... Or no, under 150, I'm sorry. I think it's in the range where I need to be put in therapy and I'm kept in therapy for a while, but I'm not put in the facility for unsolvables, so... Because there's a facility for unsolvables that they have where I love my favorite cell in those, because they show the cell of all the abandoned people, and there's a guy who's a room full of books, and then there's a guy who's tattooed his whole body. My yeah. favorite is a guy who is just a hookah. There's nothing in there. It's just him and a hookah. And I'm like, what was his thought crime? Was he too dank for society? Like, that's the guy with 420, right?
Sure. I wish they'd have done that joke. That would have been
amazing.
A great joke.
It'd be like A+. The show is the best show.
Yeah, that would have been good. Let's see here. Before we get going, we got one question from the chat that I saw. It wants to know what we think of Yon Castlevania anime, which is, I don't think it's actually anime. Directed by an American, and I'm pretty sure it's a Korean studio handling the animation, because it looks like all those direct-to-video OVAs from the early 2000s, like The Animatrix and Gotham Knight, Dante's Inferno.
I think it's done like Korra, where there's an animation studio, I believe, that's handling it in America, and then like they outsource a lot of it to Korea. I believe that's the approach.
I'll watch it. I mean, look, I'm a big Castlevania guy. My favorite.
You have to watch it.
My favorite video game ever is Symphony of the Night. I've played every game in the series. You know, my heyday of Castlevania fandom was in my 20s, but I'm interested to see the show. The way that the dude who's hyping it talks about it makes me nervous, because he's talking about, like, it's going to be the bloodiest thing. Like he's very, like, sort of... I get some douche chills a little bit, you know, hey, douches make good stuff all the time, so maybe it'll be cool, I don't know.
Corey says it's animated in Texas.
Animated in Texas, all right, well, that's cool. That's cool. Let's see, have either of you, Metal Knight, Metal King wants to know if either of you, I certainly haven't, there's a prequel manga and a game. I know you haven't played the game.
I would like to, but...
All right.
I'd like to, I haven't heard good things, but I don't want to, like, dump a bunch of money on it, really.
Yeah, well, there you go. Let's see. I think that just about does it for us. Okay, so we'll be back. Gabo, thank you so much for coming by and talking Psychopaths with us. I really appreciate your perspective on this. You helped me understand it a little bit better, I think. We'll be back next week. More than likely next week we'll get into A Silent Voice, which we also saw this week. But we'll talk about that one next week, I think.
Yeah.
So look forward to that. A Silent Voice. Yeah. I'm excited to talk about that one. I'm excited to talk about that.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, everyone. That's our show. Big thanks to Gabriella for stopping by and, of course, our live chat. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, YouTube, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Radio, all that crap. Leave us a rating and review. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.